Uncompromised, where we make reading less solitary. Episode 47. This week, we had the pleasure of talking to Anna Stevens, author of Godblind. We'll get to talk about that just a little bit later in the podcast, but welcome.
That was a really good chat.
It was a good time. It was a lot of fun. I'm excited for y'all to hear that. She put off her lunch to talk to us while we woke up at 6 a.m.
Yeah. And of course, my alarm didn't go off.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I know.
Yeah, we were scheduled to talk to her at 6 a.m. our time.
Yeah.
And so I set my alarm for 5 so we'd have time to get the equipment set up. Mm-hmm. We'd have time to test everything, make sure it was working right.
And I trusted you, so I didn't set my alarm.
You trust me. I set my alarm for 5. And then it went off, and it's one of those that it doesn't light up unless you push the button. So I hit snooze, and I laid there, okay, time to get up. And then I turn on the light, and I look over, and it's 5:48. So I'm like, no, what happened? So naturally, we had issues with equipment.
Of course.
With the time crunch.
Of course. So that's, I woke up to Jordan, your husband, walking by going, Greg, get up, time to go. I'm like, what? Huh? Okay. I started getting up, just, you know, waking up, getting out of the bed. I look at my phone. I'm like, it's 5:50. Whoa, wait a minute. What's going on?
Well, and I thought I must have fallen back asleep. Of course, I would drop the ball.
Right.
But then we're in here getting ready, and my alarm goes off again. Like, yeah. I just hit snooze. I'm right. Like, okay, it's not my fault. It can't be my fault.
And it was funny, if any of y'all listened to our gaming podcast, Charlie, or the goat from that one, was in the room the whole time sleeping on the couch. He was kind of asleep. He was awake. As soon as the interview was done, he jumped up and ran.
To the bathroom.
He was like, I've been holding that the whole time. But no, that was a lot of fun. She had some really cool points of view. I definitely love talking to authors. Is so much fun.
It is
so much fun. They have such cool points of view about their books.
I like seeing the behind the scenes
sort
of thing.
It's definitely like seeing the special features for a movie. It's getting to see where their thought process came into it, things like that. She was a joy. She was a lot of fun, especially.
She's a Doctor Who fan. How could we not hit it off?
Yeah, Doctor Who, that just settles it there. But she seems super nerdy in a good way, and I love it. She seems really relatable, but fun to hang out with. I think book-wise this week, did anything interesting for you? Anything new besides, we read Godblind this week.
Yeah, I read Godblind, which I'm almost through with it.
Yeah.
Almost through with it. I'll finish it today. Mm-hmm. Other than that, just been working through the next Terry Dresden book.
Yeah, I'm excited.
I listened to the audio for that while I work, so.
This is the second to most recent one, or is
Yeah, we've got one left after this.
We've got one left after this,
Cold Days is the one we're on book 14.
Looking forward to that one to finally get to talk about the whole series.
In a couple weeks, we're going to have an episode discussing the entire Dresden Files.
Oh, that is one series that I know there was a TV show, and it went for about a season, and it was terrible. Like, it did really bad.
I think I found it and intended to watch it, but didn't.
I remember seeing it forever ago on Netflix, long, long time ago. The first season was on Netflix, and I remember watching the first. It was before I ever read the books, and going, oh, this is terrible, and I turned it off. Because I distinctly remember Harry Dresden talking to Bob in the show, and I remember it just not being fun, not being enjoyable. Which really sucks, because I think these books could be a fantastic TV show. I think
if it was done today,
yeah.
I feel like the TV book adaptation industry is
better,
very different. Especially, I think we've talked about, like, with Netflix and with Hulu doing all their original series.
Oh, yeah,
and I feel like these TV series work harder at staying faithful to the spirit of the book, and not just filling an hour of time, you know?
Yeah, and definitely, it'd be cool to have Harry Dresden with kind of the same, not theme, but kind of the same feel as Stranger Things. Just the supernatural, creepy feeling, because that would fit so well, and then have this smart-ass wizard just, you know, insulting people the whole time. I was just a quick, like, side thing. I could see Harry Dresden doing in the D&D show. There's one point where a character actually killed a monster by insulting it.
Nice.
He had a move that takes off like a little bit of hit points, not a whole lot, but the character was just low enough that it killed itself. Like,
nice.
it took its life to zero, so the DM went, it killed itself. So I can see Harry Dresden doing that.
That's great.
It's pretty fantastic.
There is one thing this week the in Texas, we're in Texas, there is a Harry Potter wizarding school, I think in Killeen, like next weekend.
In Texas.
In Texas.
I'm calling off work.
Yeah, right? Me too.
You said it's a school or?
Yeah, Worthwich School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, holding a 3-day magical retreat later this month in Central Texas. The school is only for those 21 years and older.
Yeah.
And it's about $400 a ticket, though. Oh. but it includes magical sports. Why don't they just say Quidditch? Okay. Herbology, magical creatures, divination, and more. I want to go.
That would be fun.
That would be a ton of fun.
$400 a ticket, though. Oh, my gosh. That's how much.
That's probably like food and everything. Food. True.
There's probably food provided.
Room. Yeah. Everything's probably taken care of in that. So for a weekend, that's really not that bad.
That makes sense. I was going to say that's the same price as the plane ticket we're taking in December to go with the family.
Yeah, this is just a few hours away from us, though.
True. So Christmas? Oh, no, I'm just kidding.
Do we have any other news? Do you have anything else, Greg?
I did find a couple other interesting things. Now, I can't remember who won last year. But I do remember talking about last year that about the Man Booker Prize, which is a British, I believe, a British book award. Basically, I guess it's kind of thing for the Man Booker Award. Well, for the longest time, it was naturally a mostly British authors, or I want to say European authors. I think I don't think it was just exclusively British that just won, but an American author hadn't won it in a long time. And just last year, won for the first time, and I want to say it was at least like 20 years, something like that, did.
Okay.
And this year, second year in a row, an American author has won it. George Saunders with The Lincoln in the Bardo.
I haven't read any of his work, but I understand he's very, very popular.
Oh, and it looks like it's a historical fiction. It looks like it has to do with Abraham Lincoln's 11-year-old son, I guess, who had passed away of typhoid fever. And it says something about Willie is the son's name, is joined by a garrulous, motley community of ghosts who exist in the liminal state between life and death.
I think his work is one of those that if I ever feel the need to take a break from fantasy or sci-fi for one book at a time, because it's only ever one book, and then I need more fantasy and sci-fi.
Oh, yeah.
I think his is on my list if I need to check him out.
Paul Bettany was the one last year, the other American that won. He had the movie, the book called The Sellout. It's just kind of cool that with this, it was a award that was predominantly not American writers winning it in 2 years in a row. I was reading here that some people were asking the judges if they were trying to give it to Americans, if they were leaning that way, trying to get a more diverse crowd in it. And one of the judges, a Miss Young, said that we don't look at nationality of the writer. We're solely concerned with the book and with what the book is telling us. So,
I doubt that I've read any authors that were contenders for that prize. Yeah. But I've heard a lot of good things about George Saunders. So,
yeah. So that was good for him that he got to be the second American to win that prize. We're America's. We're trying to take over the rest of the world.
That's
so,
right.
Yeah. America.
America. Go America.
Gotta get my southern roots going there. The other one I had
was you are beating me up with news this week.
I know. I
couldn't find anything. What is going on?
I have more news stories than you do. This
is
rare.
I don't like this.
This is the first time in 47.
You're fired, Greg. I can't handle this.
You'll be talking to yourself.
Nuh-uh. I'll be talking to Anna Stevens.
Oh, there you go.
I'll cut your parts out and voice over them myself.
That would be so funny just to have her like have a fluid and normal conversation and then you cutting in going, what did you think about this? You just like robot trying to. But the next conversation is one I think that's been around for a long time, talking about what is okay for our kids to read. To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee was taken off the Mississippi school reading list.
Of course it was.
Now, the reason for it, the reason that was said, that was posted here, this is I'm reading from The Guardian, The Guardian's website, their article. I guess parents were complaining because it says makes people uncomfortable, but it was obviously parents because the kids aren't going to care. My best guess is going to be parents, but they said that the book was making people uncomfortable because of foul language.
So So what age group? What, like, I'm assuming it was a school library. So was it like a middle school library?
Removed from a junior high reading list. So okay, it was a middle
if you
school.
Honestly think your 12-year-old isn't cursing behind your back, I've got another thing coming to
because
you.
Because the language in the book makes people uncomfortable, is what it said. There were complaints about it. This was the vice president of the school board. There were complaints about it. There is some language in the book that makes people uncomfortable, and we can teach the same lesson with other books. It's still in our library, but they're going to use another book in the 8th grade course. So it looks like they're not removing it from the library, but they're not...
They're removing it from the curriculum.
They're removing it from the curriculum. They're not having the kids analyze it, which...
I mean, as long as it's still available for whoever wants it to read it, I guess I won't complain too loudly.
That's not terrible. It's not being completely removed.
Yeah.
But that just seems like a silly reason for just the language. Like, I could get if every other word was a swear word.
Yeah.
But I don't think it is, because it's been a long time since I've read To Kill a Mockingbird.
Yeah, same here.
It was middle school, I think, for me when I read it. A concerned reader referred to the book's use of the word, the N-word. I'm not going to say it. When it said the school board's decision was made mid-lesson plan. Students will not be allowed to finish reading To Kill a Mockingbird due to the use of the N-word.
But isn't, and like you said, it's been forever since I've read it, isn't racism a theme in To Kill a Mockingbird? So,
because I know the book's about not judging somebody by their race, I believe, mm-hmm. and not automatically assuming. Because I know the majority of the book is based on a African-American that is accused of raping a white woman, even though he didn't do it. I know that's a big, big part of it.
Yeah.
I think it's in Mississippi. I think the story is in a southern state.
Yeah, I don't know that.
Yeah.
I can't words. I mean, that's like in Django, mm-hmm. how so many, like Leonardo DiCaprio said the N-word a bunch.
Yeah,
But even he was uncomfortable with it. But it was part of that time period to gloss over that ignores a big thing, like
and I mean, I think the use of the N-word in it, I don't think Harper Lee was racist. I don't believe so.
I mean, if the book was about racism, I'm sure that's the reason that word was in there.
Exactly,
was to further that point.
Yeah, I don't think it was ever used as a
just casually.
Right. No, it wasn't used as a, I feel like putting this in. It was a purposeful, this is what the culture was like. This is what the culture is like in some places. Of course, this was an older book. I don't know how old.
60s, I want to say?
Yeah, so definitely still around during that time. That culture was still...
Civil rights movement.
Yeah, still very relevant. So use of that word made sense. As long as it wasn't, you know, every other sentence. As long as it fit the story.
I mean, I go back. I mean, as long as it's still available for whoever wants to read it to read it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure they'll put another book there in the curriculum, so it's not like the kids aren't reading.
Yeah.
So it's
not as bad as it initially sounds, because it's not... They're not banning it. Because I remember when we were younger, and I remember hearing about schools all over the country banning Harry Potter.
Why?
Because of religious beliefs and the witchcraft and wizardry in it. And it's...
Oh, are we going to ban, like, Macbeth as well?
Yeah. Yeah.
There's witchcraft in there.
There's more than witchcraft in there. There's lots
of
murder.
I'm sure many high schoolers would appreciate removing Shakespeare from the curriculum.
Actually, I mean, a lot of high schoolers wouldn't mind at all. Yeah, it's crazy what people will do. We've been reading some grim dark books. I could get not giving those to a junior high school kid.
I mean, there are some themes that should be kept to separate ages. Like, I wouldn't put To Kill a Mockingbird in the curriculum of a third grader.
No, they wouldn't get it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The themes go over their head. But an eighth grader, 13 years old, I feel like that's about appropriate.
Well, it's like with Charlotte, you know, she's your daughter. She's how old now? I'm so bad with age.
She's seven.
Seven, thank you. I see. You think I would remember that, because she was born in 2010.
Yeah, right?
Makes the year I graduated high school. You wouldn't show her Django. Like, you wouldn't.
Right.
Yeah, you wouldn't sit her down and
say, she leaves the room when we watch Game of Thrones.
Exactly. You know, it's there is a line to draw, but when it comes to something like that, well, like we said, they're not banning it completely, so it's not a big deal. But if they were banning it, it'd be like, come on, just for that, that's not a good enough reason.
Yeah.
Ah, people.
People, I tell you, people.
Well, it was a slow news week this week.
It was a weird news week.
Yeah.
I'm still upset about that you found more than I did.
You have to come back with fire next week.
I know, and I only found that Harry Potter thing because my sister-in-law tagged me in it.
It's not a bad thing. Harry Potter is always good. Always good.
And I didn't want there to be a hole in our podcast for Harry Potter news.
No, we got to have Harry Potter.
Okay.
All right. So there we go. Newsy news. All done.
All done. Time to go into our interview with Anna Stevens.
Yay.
Who is wonderful.
Yeah. It was fantastic. We want to thank her for coming on. It was so much fun. We do want to say that we're not doing our usual spoiler review that
yes.
we do here.
Yes, this talk is spoiler free.
This talk is spoiler free. There's one part actually, Danny, I remember you asked a question that got spoilery and Anna
was like, I knew if it was spoilery, then we won't go into it.
And she was like, that's kind of spoilery. And we went, okay, we'll wait. So, yep, don't worry about spoilers. Come in, enjoy yourself, and there we go.
Also, if you have not voted for the Book Nest Awards, go do that. They are down to the short list, 10 books on each category. I have voted. Greg needs to vote. I'll make him do that after we are done here.
I'm going right now.
Wait, we're not done yet.
Oh, sorry.
Next week, I believe, for our Halloween episode, because it'll come out on the 30th of October, the day before Halloween, we're going to be reading Dracula by Bram Stoker.
Whoa.
Jump in our Wayback Machine. Read us a classic.
I'm pretty excited for that one, even though classics haven't gone well for me.
It's
Dracula. Hopefully it'll be good.
Put us in the spirit for the season.
Yeah. All right, and here's the interview with Anna Stevens. All right, we are here with the author of Godblind, Anna Stevens. Hello, how are you doing today?
Hi, guys. I am really good. I'm very excited to be on the show and looking forward to your questions.
Awesome. We are so happy to have you here. We read Godblind this week and had a good time.
92% through it. I'm almost through. Almost there.
Yeah, I'm so used to listening to audiobooks with my full-time job that when I went to go find the one here, we found out it wasn't available here in the U.S. So this is the one different one for us. I had to actually read this week. But it was.
Oh, that's really. I mean, I know that there is an audio version of it out. Maybe you can't get it in America then. I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, we looked up. It was only available in the UK right now, but we were able to get the Kindle version. Danny here has the actual book from the library that she's been reading, and I got it on the Kindle version. I've been reading it off that one, so.
Excellent. I'm really thrilled to hear that it's available in libraries. I think that's it's really important to get the new stuff in the libraries as well.
Oh, definitely.
Okay, so first thing that I wanted to ask, I understand you're a big Doctor Who fan, so I needed to know which Doctor is your Doctor.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so by age, my Doctors are the Doctors that I grew up with when I was from a small child was Colin Baker and Sylvester McCoy.
Good choices.
So they were like my childhood Doctors, but probably, well, my all-time favorite. The fourth Doctor.
The fourth? Okay. All right.
He's a very popular favorite.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. So I really like the... I love the modern Doctors. I really do. I cannot wait for this new season to come out with a female Doctor.
Oh, definitely.
But yeah, I really like the old school ones. I love the monsters in the rubber suits and the, you know, the bubble wrap aliens and the really shoddy camera work. Yeah, I just think it just adds to the magic, totally.
That's awesome. Yeah, I know we got into Doctor Who with the modern ones.
Yeah.
And so that's, I know for me personally, it's David Tennant. I've always loved David Tennant. He's my favorite.
Man, I can't pick a favorite. I just can't.
David Tennant was definitely cool. I've got his... sonic screwdriver on my desk.
Oh, very nice. Very nice.
I just wave it around every so often and hope inspiration will strike.
David Tennant, help me.
Yes, precisely.
So getting into Godblind, do you want to kind of give a quick synopsis or a quick little...
tell us what it's about in your words.
Yeah, sure. Okay. So it's my debut novel. So obviously over the moon about that because I've had my lifelong ambition fulfilled to actually see my book published. It is the story of two separate peoples, so the people of Realport and the people of Miracies, who have basically been engaged in a border skirmish for about 1,000 years, and the time has eventually come for the Miracies to complete the conquest of Realport, and they are driven by their gods, the Red Gods, who are also known as the Gods of Blood, who have been cast out of Realport and the surrounding countries by the Gods of Light. So they're obviously just all about the revenge. So they sort of inspire the Miracies to plan the invasion of Realport, and it's the story of people on both sides, so it's the good guys and the bad guys. So we get both perspectives, and it's, I think at its heart, it's the story of the little people in the war. Mm-hmm. So although there's, you know, there's kings and generals and princes, it's really, it's about ordinary people and what happens when you get caught up in a war and just how far you are prepared to go for what you believe in. Because at the end of the day, the Miracies and the Realporians, they both believe they're right. They both think that they're fighting a just war for a just cause. So it's just the exploration of, can the guys on the bad side still be right, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
So they utterly believe that they are fighting for the right reasons. So I was just quite interested in exploring that dynamic.
Mm-hmm. It's definitely a very interesting angle to take, and it was really fun to look at.
I know on Goodreads, somebody had asked you what inspired you to create a dark mythology-based fantasy like Godblind, and part of your answer was that you've always been fascinated by religion and how people can use it to justify committing all sorts of horrors. What is it about these red gods that make the Miracies willing to follow them? Like, how do they justify all the bloodshed that their gods require?
Okay, well, I think a lot of people, you know, at our core, everyone is selfish and everyone wants what they want. So they want to always get things to go their way. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a god who says, you know, I will make you powerful, I will make you rich, all you have to do is give me your soul, then it's like the old devil worship thing. You know, mm-hmm. there are always people who are willing to do it. And someone else put a Goodreads review on saying, I just don't understand why anyone would follow the Red Gods. I mean, why? Yeah. Why would you? And I was like, okay, well, that's a really interesting question. Because I've actually been reading a lot about the ancient Aztec and Maya religions and their way of life and society. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, well, you know, back in its heyday, the Maya were sacrificing like 1,000 people a day to their gods.
Yeah, like putting hearts on altars and all that, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and just like take them up to the pyramid, cut the heart out, chop the head off, chuck them down the steps, and then the next and the next and the next. And I'm like, well, you know, it's the same question. Why on earth would you worship gods who demand 1,000 dead deaths a day? It's, if you are brought up in that religion, you don't think there's anything wrong with it.
Yeah,
it's like
true.
A lot of, you know, a lot of fundamental people who are, you know, absolutely convinced that, you know, the Bible is correct word for word, or that the Quran is correct word for word, or, you know, whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. And that you can justify anything. If you look hard enough, there is always a way to justify what you are doing and say that it is ordained by God.
Okay.
You said this was a lifelong fantasy. How long did it take you to write this, to fully, like, from when you officially sat down and said, all right, I'm going to write it?
I get asked this quite a lot, mostly because people can't believe the answer. So from first draft to publication was 13 years.
Wow.
So I basically rewrote it, I would say, once a year. So I would write it, send it out on submission, have it rejected, rewrite it, send it out on submission, have it rejected, for 13 years. So a lot of other authors that I've chatted to have said, I would have just written something else. I'm like, well, yeah, okay, fair enough.
I think...
I was just always convinced that it had to be this book. This book had to be the first book that I got published. I don't know why. I think it's just because it's been such a big part of my life for such a long time that the thought of abandoning it for something else was just impossible.
Do you have any other works that didn't make it to publication, or was this your first one and you were dedicated to getting it there?
I think because it's gone through so many changes, it is basically a different book. The very first iteration of it was a Tolkien-esque high fantasy, which sounds ridiculous when you think about a lot of the stuff that happens in Godblind. But for instance, Rillerin, who's the escaped slave, in the first version, she was a princess. She was a pampered, spoiled little bitch. and she ends up becoming a traumatized, PTSD suffering, abused slave. So it was like another book anyway. but I do also have a draft and a half. So a draft and then another draft of a sci-fi novel that I wrote some years ago, which is hidden on my hard drive and may possibly see the light of day. but it would need an awful lot of work. That was back in my first person point of view days. So I'd need to totally rewrite it into third person now anyway, because I can't work in first person anymore. So yeah. And then there were some short stories and bits and bobs like that. But other than that, it was just been Godblind all the way.
Okay.
All right. So you have 2 degrees in literature and creative writing from Open University, a second Dan black belt in, how do I pronounce it? Shotokan karate. You're a qualified massage therapist, a qualified proofreader, and a certified first aider. So as a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up?
Well, there's two answers to this. Well, everybody that I knew who was 6 wanted to be a vet.
Oh, yeah.
So I wanted to be a vet for a while.
Because puppies, yay.
I grew up, my dad and my uncle and my great uncle were all firefighters. Oh, so I absolutely wanted to be a firefighter, but I've got poor eyesight. So I wouldn't have been accepted. But even to this day, I would have joined the fire service without a shadow of a doubt. But I did always want to be a writer. I always wrote. I always made up stories. English was always my favorite class at school. Whenever, the teacher set homework to go and write a story, it was just the best thing ever. I was like, I get to do homework, I get to write stories. So you can imagine that I was horribly bullied at school because, I was like, yay, homework.
You're the kid in class that put their hand up and say, hey, didn't we have homework to turn in? And the other kids glared at you. Yeah. Right,
I
there with.
Get wedged for it
afterwards. English was not my favorite class because I didn't mind the reading part, but it was when the teacher started asking us to analyze the books, like, why was that curtain purple?
And I'll now be like, that's all we do.
It's like, because it was purple. And they're like, no, it had the feelings or something. It'd go into some details. And I'm like, no, it's a purple curtain. It doesn't really matter.
It matched the decor.
I loved all that kind of stuff as well, all like the analytical side and stuff. And I think I do actually have to correct you. I don't have 2 degrees. I have 1 degree and 1 diploma.
Which
is slightly different in the UK.
Sorry about that.
I would love to have 2 degrees, but, but I don't have the time anymore. But yeah, I think when I graduated from university and I'd done, all this analyzing of books and plays and poetry, blah blah blah, it kind of ruined me for reading for pleasure for a good couple of years, because I kept finding myself going, really? No, I wouldn't have written it like that. Or, what's the significance of the purple curtain? It was all this kind of stuff for ages. So I'm now just trying to get back into just reading for fun and not thinking about it too deeply.
Yeah, definitely.
Because reading is great.
It is. I agree.
How did being well-versed in a form of physical combat help or hinder the writing of the fight scenes?
I would say that it helped an awful lot. There's a couple of guys that I still know from back in my karate days who have read it, and they were like, yeah, we could picture it completely. Oh, we knew exactly what you were saying when you said, you know, you step through on the right, pivot on the left, you know, all that kind of stuff. They could totally picture it. And there's, you know, there's a couple of other people that I know who've done different forms of martial arts, or, you know, like have been in the army or something like that, and they've all said that they could see it happening. So it does absolutely help. And I think it's incredibly important that if you're going to write a fight scene, that you do actually know what you're doing to a certain extent, because, you know, I mean, yes, we can all write about fighting a dragon because it's completely made up. But if you are going to talk about two men going toe to toe with fists and knives, then you do, I think personally, that you need to make it sound and feel as real as possible. So I've got this slightly embarrassing habit of actually walking through the fight in my office. So I just close the door and I get my my wooden practice sword out, and I just start hacking away at the air. and then, you know, it's like my husband walks in and says, "What the hell are you doing? Make a fight scene. Leave me alone." Or actually, no, just stand there and now take a punch. He's like, no. So I walk it through from both points of view, just to make sure that it works, no matter how you read it.
Oh, very cool.
So it's good fun. It is good fun.
What would you say was the most challenging scene to write?
Because
obviously you've got it down with the fight scenes. I think that you're pretty comfortable with those.
I can probably tell you the most challenging character to write, which is Galtas. Who is the one-eyed chief bodyguard / assassin / all-round dirty bastard who works for Prince Rival. To be honest, every time I have to write a scene with him, he makes my skin crawl.
Understandably.
Yes. And so I really hope that does come through in the novel for readers, because basically anybody who likes Galtas needs to go and see a psychiatrist because he is, you know, he's an absolutely just evil, horrible character. And I did actually have to tone down one of his scenes a little bit, which is the scene towards the end with John and Mara, who Chris's parents.
Right.
And they just, you know, the editor said, "I like what you're doing with it, but I think we've already established the depths of his nastiness, and it just feels slightly gratuitous to go into the kind of detail that you're going into." And to be honest, I was quite relieved to take it out in the end, because I was thinking, you know, how much, you know, I don't want to kind of get a reputation for, like, torture porn or something, which right. Is what someone else is actually, another Goodreads review said that it devolved into torture porn at times. So I was a bit like, okay, it's a really good job you didn't read that full scene then.
I think we didn't have that one then.
Yeah, so he's definitely the most difficult character to write. So scenes with him do make me uncomfortable. And then I would say probably the scene right at the start with Rillerin and Lyris, because
mm-hmm.
I wanted to make her motivations clear, but I didn't want it to be yet another, bad stuff happens to women in fantasy novels,
right,
kind of thing. So, you know, I wanted it to be, look, this has been her life for 9 years, but this is the point where she finally snaps and finds her courage.
Understandably.
And just, sorry?
I was saying she snaps understandably after 9 years of yes. that. Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, she takes her first step on the road to self-healing, really. And she does that because she's pretty much backed into a corner and it's that or, you know, as far as she's concerned, it's that or die.
Mm-hmm.
But everything that falls, that flows out from that, is how she starts to heal herself, rather than let other, you know, allow other people to heal her. It's a journey of self-discovery for her. But the scene, you know, this what happens to her in the scene that leads to that is quite unpleasant as well. So I wanted to sort of describe the horror of it, but not again make it gratuitous. I wanted there to be some sort of sensitivity there, and you know, hopefully that came across as well.
I understand that in publication there were four different point of views that were dropped. Which characters were those that were dropped, or were any characters totally dropped?
There were no characters totally dropped. I think at one point, pretty much every character who has a name in Godblind at one point had a point of view.
Hmm.
And yes, that is quite a lot of people. So
yeah, it'd be fun.
So Rival himself, he's not a point of view character now, but he used to be. Mm-hmm. Valen, who is Corvus's second in command. Mm-hmm. Halos, who's the chief physician. King Rastoth himself. Dom's brother, Lim. Lim's wife, Cirilla.
Oh, wow.
Dali, who's the spearwoman. I think that's about it. I think that was seven, actually. So that was 17 point of view characters.
King Rastos was probably interesting with how, I mean, I guess in the beginning it shows he's kind of going mad a little bit. So that had to be interesting to write.
It was, yeah. It was really fun. It was fun to write, but it was just, if you can effectively show it through Dirdil's point of view,
mm-hmm.
Or even Galtus's point of view, then it's a more interesting dynamic if you can see how they react to his increasing confusion and his increasing madness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, especially for Dirdil, who's, you know, they've been friends for 40 years, and he's, you know, they've been on campaign together, they've fought wars together, and you know, this great, strong, wise king who has just been completely undone by the murder of his wife. And it was interesting to write Rastoth's decline from Dirdil's point of view, because he's just so desperately sad that his friend and his king is losing himself. And there's nothing that he can do about it. So it was as much... As interesting as it was to write Rastoth, it was more interesting to write him through Dirdil's eyes. So I think that was definitely the right call to lose that particular point of view.
Okay.
And I want to ask, like, every fantasy author this, but where do y'all get the names of, you know, the cities, the people? Because anytime I've tried to even think of a stuff like that, it always comes sounding out fake for me. But when I read books like yours, the names always, they just fit. And it works. So I was just curious, where did you get yours?
So if we go back into the mists of time to 13 years ago. So the first three characters that I wrote were Dom, Lim, and Rillerin.
Okay.
So all of the other names kind of flowed from those three. So if you go through it, there's a lot of L's, and there's a lot of names that end in A's.
Mm-hmm.
So Dali, Cirilla, Lim, Gilda, Rillerin, Rival, Court, you know, they all have this, the same sort of sound to them and the same sort of flow.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted, but then for the Miracies, you've got Lanta and Corvus and Valen, and they're very different. So I wanted there to be a kind of similarity, and it's almost like it sort of indicates a family in with the Rilporians, with their nationality, that they have names that have L's and A's and things like that, and multiple syllable names.
Mm-hmm.
And then make Lanta and Corvus and Fost very different because they're from another country. So really I just played around with sounds rather than having a definite idea in mind, and then it all sort of came together from that. But you know, the sounds of like the L's and things like that, I don't know whether I was sort of channeling a slightly Celtic kind of a feel to them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't they that's it.
Very cool, very cool. As I've nerded out on D&D lately, and just to make my character's name for the game,
Greg needs more advice for naming his D&D character. Not
I just I had to go to a fantasy name generator online to find it, so and I found one that way. Right, so
okay. What is his name?
Elmorn Arroway.
Ooh. Yeah, okay.
He's a wizard who loves books, so I relate to him.
That sounds good. It does sound quite, again, it sounds sort of like quite Celtic or Gaelic or something like that, doesn't it? Which I always think fits a lot of, you know, like D&D characters and a lot of fantasy characters. I think there is that sort of, there's almost like a tradition to give them something that sounds like it's not too far away from an existing name.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's my first time playing, so I wanted to make a character that I could relate to. So he loves stories about heroes and fighting and fantasy novels, and he wants to be one, so.
Cool.
Yeah, yeah.
Sounds good.
Well, I'm just curious because I just find it really interesting, the earlier versions of the book. Is there anything else that was cut that you can tell us about? I know you've already told us quite a bit about the POVs and King Rastoth and Rhaelirin being a princess.
Okay, so in the earliest versions, Rhaelirin was a princess, which means that her brother was Rival, not Corvus.
Okay. Yeah.
Which is why their names sound the way they do, Rhaelirin and Rival.
Oh, okay.
So they've got that link. So because the characters were so established, when I made the decision that she wasn't going to be a princess, so obviously she wasn't going to be his sister anymore. But the characters were so established that I couldn't change the names. It just would have felt wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So I just changed the backstory, their history and everything like that. But I kept the names the same. So that's why they sound as they do, because they were twins.
Oh, nice.
Okay. If it's possible to discuss this, because like I said, I'm at like 92% through. So I'm not totally done. So I don't know if I just haven't gotten there yet. What does it mean to be godblind?
Oh, You are actually going to learn that.
Okay. I'm almost there then.
So I can tell you if you want, or you can go out of the room for 2 minutes.
I'll just finish it today.
Okay. But yeah, you do find out what it means. I was actually having this discussion in the pub with my brother-in-law last night. And he was saying that he's just finished it, and he said that he likes the fact that you do get to learn what godblind means, because a lot of people ask that question, what does the title mean? So the next two books, they're also going to have a title that will relate to something that you will learn about through the novels.
Yeah, there's quite a few books I've read in the past that the name was just kind of weird and off the wall and didn't really have anything to do with the book. So it's always kind of cool to be reading a book, and then a part comes up, you're like, oh, that's why.
Yeah, definitely.
Has meeting other authors through the editing and publishing process affected the way you approach your writing or your writing process?
I suppose it's kind of reassured me that at the end of the day, we're all in the same boat, and we all have good days and bad days and days where we just want to scratch our own eyes out. Ed McDonald, who's the author of Blackwing, which came out quite recently as well, he said that he has a spreadsheet, and the spreadsheet has a one-line synopsis of each chapter, and then underneath that, when he's going through the editing phase, it will have another line that says what needs to be changed in that chapter. So I tried to do that for my final round of edits for Godblind, and I'm not entirely sure it was successful. I don't think I quite grasped what he meant by a spreadsheet, because I was just writing like 300 words for each chapter in there, and then having to go and write that chapter again. So I think I just made more work for myself. So I might try and pin him down a little bit more on what he actually means by spreadsheeting each chapter. But I know that Jen Williams does the same, who wrote the Copper Cat trilogy, which I think is out in the US now and is absolutely fabulous. So yes, she spreadsheets as well, but I just don't understand what it adds to the process. But I do think that one thing that I've noticed because I'm currently editing Dark Soul, which is book two, is that what I really need is a document of bullet points that says, Dom goes here, Dom does this, Lynn goes here, Chris goes there, because I find I'm having to keep reading back through Godblind to work out where everybody is. So just a master document that says where everybody is, because I spent probably most of a day earlier this week writing these chapters about what the Miracies did after the ending of Godblind, only to flick back through the ending of Godblind and realize they never went where I said they'd gone.
Oh no.
So that was like a day's work waste.
Oh man.
So I definitely need a master document. But it's just finding the time to actually write the master document when you're supposed to be editing.
Well, what is it about fantasy and grimdark in particular that made you know that that was the genre that you wanted to write in?
I've always been a huge fantasy fan. Fantasy and historical fiction have been my two great loves to read when I was growing up. So I always knew it was going to be a fantasy novel. There was never any doubt it was going to be your traditional medieval-esque fantasy novel. Mm-hmm. With the grimdark thing, I didn't realize I was writing grimdark until my editor said, oh, that's a grimdark book. Is it now? Okay, I thought it was just epic fantasy.
With lots of blood.
Yeah.
Yeah. but I think it was more just as the years went by and as the rewrites went by from Godblind, the high fantasy with the noble princesses and, you know, the woods living warriors, mm-hmm. and, you know, all these kind of traditional classic fantasy tropes. They weren't quite real enough for me, written in that form. They weren't quite three-dimensional enough. The good were very good. The bad were very bad. There was no grey in the middle. So every time I rewrote it, they got a little bit more three-dimensional, a little bit more morally ambiguous. Mm-hmm. The bad guys occasionally did good stuff. The good guys occasionally did bad stuff. And every rewrite where that increased, they felt more and more alive to me. Mm-hmm. Until it got to the point where I realized that, yes, I was definitely now writing epic fantasy rather than high fantasy. And I just always used to describe it in my submission letters as gritty epic fantasy, and I would still argue that that is what I write. Some people say it's definitely grimdark. Some people say it's definitely epic. I don't really mind either way, to be honest with you. As long as you read it and enjoy it, I'm happy.
You can definitely tell that with the characters just feeling more real, more believable. I think I prefer characters that are believable over fully good or fully evil. Characters that you can relate to are definitely more interesting to read.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, while we may all aspire to be these wonderful, noble creatures with high ideals and, you know, rigid codes of honor and stuff like that, when it comes to it, you know, we're all willing to kick someone in the nuts if it's going to save our life. It's not noble, no. But it's going to save us. So.
But it's going to work.
Yeah, definitely.
Were there any particular authors, going back to the ones you've worked with, were there any particular authors that influenced your writing style?
Not just that you've worked with, that read as well.
Right.
I think that's actually a really hard question to answer. Mm-hmm. Clearly, I don't want to be accused of plagiarism, so...
Right.
For that reason, I should say nobody. It's all my own style. As I said, I did grow up reading a lot of epic fantasy and Tolkien. And I think, you know, the first version of Godblind was probably a Tolkien ripoff, but without elves and dragons and orcs. So not at all a Tolkien ripoff in that case. But, you know, like the style and the tone of it and stuff like that, I did make a conscious effort. Authors that I really love that may or may not have sort of had an influence is I'll say the obvious, you know, Joe Abercrombie, Mark Lawrence, Scott Lynch. I'm staring at my bookshelf at the moment trying to figure it out. But also I think because of my English literature degree, I studied a lot of people that I wouldn't have studied otherwise. I did a whole year on Shakespeare, which I wouldn't say is a clear influence. But what I loved about that was the way that he could just present these scenarios. So A Midsummer Night's Dream, you know, he just presents the fact that there's fairies and people go, okay, there's fairies, that's fine.
Totally.
Nobody questions it because it's clear that it's the story. So I think I kind of took from that the fact that if you present something confidently enough, people just go with it. Whereas if you're sort of trying to over explain why you've done something, then you sound like you're not sure about yourself.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
So,
well, fantasy,
yeah,
is,
so I think I got that. And also, you know, I mean, Hamlet and Macbeth, there's just blood everywhere.
Yeah.
So maybe I am more influenced by Shakespeare than I thought.
That fits a lot.
Now, I guess a fantasy is more popular nowadays, so I think it's pretty easy for somebody to go, oh, okay, there's fairies, you know. Oh, there are two sets of gods. Yeah. One's good, one's bloody.
Yeah, one's bloody. I like it.
It's been mentioned a lot online that 2017 is the year for fantasy debuts. As a debut fantasy author yourself, do you think there's a reason for that, or is it just all happenstance, just coincidence?
It has definitely been a strong year. There's been six major that I know of. There's been six major debuts this year. So there's me, Ed McDonald, RJ Barker, Nicholas Eames, Deborah Wolf, and Anna Smith Spark. So it's really nicely weighted as well. So there's three men and three women. And we've all written very different books, but they're definitely all in the epic fantasy genre, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are first person, some of them are multiple point of view, some of them are third person. You know, it's a real mixed bag. And Adrian Tchaikovsky, the author of Children of Time, he did a blog post recently about the six of us. And he said, so what was it that agents and editors were thinking 18 months/2 years ago when they signed all of these books? And he said, the answer is, I have absolutely no idea because they're all so different. So it's not like there's a common theme in everything that we've done. There's nothing, I don't think there's anything really that you can point to and say, okay, they clearly wanted books about religion, for instance, because they've all got religious aspects, but to varying degrees and to varying, you know, there's various levels of involvement from the gods with the gods, you know, all that kind of stuff. It's They're all very, very different books. So I don't know whether, you know, I mean, if we were all signed probably say 2 years ago, so what was happening in 2015 that made us write the books we wrote? I don't know. I think we've just, you know, we've hit this really fertile patch, and
for fantasy,
you know, four of us are UK, one's US, one's Canada.
And
I don't think you can really put your finger on it.
The only thing I can think is that the insane success of Game of Thrones has made everyone go, okay, apparently fantasy sells now.
Yeah, but it could well be, you know, it could well be. I mean, you've got things like Joe Abercrombie hits the, you know, New York Times bestseller list, the Sunday Times bestseller list every time a book comes out, and that is rare for a fantasy novel. Peter V. Brett's a New York Times bestseller as well, isn't he?
I think so,
yeah.
There's obviously a wave of fantasy that we are all fortunate enough to be riding at the moment. But I tell you what, it's making it awkward for the awards.
Oh, no.
Because everyone's like, right, well, you're obviously going to be in the best debut novel category, blah, blah, blah. But then it's like, well, yeah, but I know that those five guys are going to be in it as well. So, you know, it's everyone saying that it's going to be really tough to call for the awards next year, but... To be honest, even if I just got on the list, I would be thrilled.
Yeah,
definitely. I think you are on the BookNest list.
I'm on the BookNest list.
Very cool.
Yeah,
congratulations.
I'm on the shortlist for that at the moment. So voting closes 31st of October.
Yep, I voted.
If you'd like to vote for Godblind, that'd be lovely.
Just because I'm a nerd about movies and TV shows, if Godblind was made into a movie, who would you want playing the characters?
I have been asked this question before. Mm. Okay, so Durdil would be Morgan Freeman.
There okay. you go.
Galtas would be Idris Elba.
Ooh, that's a good one. I like it. I like Idris Elba.
Tara, do you guys have the TV show Killjoys?
I've heard of it, but I don't think I've watched it.
Okay, so there's an actress in Killjoys called Hannah John Kamen. And she's just like really sassy and bad mouthed and really cool in a fight and all this kind of stuff. So she'd be Tara. Mm-hmm. Diego Luna, who played Cassian Andor in Rogue One.
Oh, okay, yeah.
He would be Chris. Who else did I come up with? And Rose Leslie, who played Ygritte in Game of Thrones.
Oh, very nice.
Would be Rillerin.
There you go. Not bad.
Okay. I would watch that.
You can tell I put thought in.
Very, very cool.
I think that's all the questions that we had.
Woohoo.
Okay.
Is there anything else that you would like to discuss before we go? Anything else you'd like to add?
Upcoming projects, anything you're wanting to talk about? Yeah.
So I suppose it's probably worth mentioning that the paperback comes out, I believe, in March next year in the UK.
Okay.
So possibly April next year in the US.
Oh, very cool.
And then book two, which is called Dark Soul, drops at the end of May in the UK. So again, I assume end of June in the US.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've read God Blind and liked it, please do leave a review because they all help.
Okay. Okay.
Awesome.
Well, where can anybody find you if they wanted to drop you a line somewhere?
Okay, so my website is anna-stevens.com. My Twitter handle, slightly confusingly, is at Anna Smith Writes. And I'm on Facebook as Anna Stevens, and I'm on Instagram as Anna Smith Writes. So I'm either Anna Smith or I'm Anna Stevens.
Just take a guess.
It depends, you know, which superhero disguise I'm in at any particular time.
Right. gotta keep those book babies you said you have safe.
Yes. Yeah, definitely. Got my cape on.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you very much. I've had a really great chat and lovely to virtually meet you.
It was nice to meet you too.
Thank you.
So we want to thank Anna for coming on the show and talking to us about God Blind.
I love that she nerds out like I do, and like she was talking about the fighting. Mm-hmm. How she's like in her office playing with the sword, fighting, like has a fake sword in her hand, is using it, then uses her husband as a
stand there.
I'm gonna stab you real quick. Hold on. But we had a really good time. She was a lot of fun to talk to. I am definitely looking forward to talking to her some more and seeing what comes next.
So, again, watch out for us next week reading Dracula by Bram Stoker. Till then, everybody have a wonderful week.
Too spooky.